Well, Pastor Sally, you really set me up for success there during the time with children, so I don't know what I'll solve about the transfiguration, but let's talk about it a little this morning. We've been following Jesus these last weeks. Since Epiphany, we followed the infant Jesus into and out of Egypt. We followed a newly baptized Jesus out of the waters and into the wilderness. We followed sojourner Jesus as he calls disciples, casts out demons per Pastor Sally's sermon a couple of weeks ago, and heals sick cities per Pastor Elijah's sermon last week. And today we follow Jesus up the side of a mountain as he awaits the arrival of his ancestors and the blessing of God. This moment in Mark's gospel sits at pretty much exactly the halfway point in the book, in the texts, right in between baptism and resurrection, almost as if the text itself was standing at the top of a mountain looking back and looking forward. Don't tell me the biblical writers didn't have a flair for the literarily dramatic, right? Anyway, this moment, which we call the transfiguration of Jesus, which is mostly just a fancy word for transformation, but much more fabulous. This moment pulls in images from something that has already happened, his baptism, and something that is yet to come, his resurrection. And as God calls Jesus beloved, as we heard, like God did at his baptism, and Jesus is transcendent, dazzling, and bright, like at his resurrection, you're getting the idea here, I hope, something else really curious happens in this moment. As Jesus gathers on this mountain with his peers, all of a sudden, his ancestors show up. Now, you may well know that African Americans have long looked to their ancestors for strength in an inhospitable, deadly land like this one. Something about knowing that millions of unnamed slaves were still present, were named, were carried forward in the blood and bodies of those who walk with us today. Something about that has long been empowering to people whose histories have been taken from them. Indigenous peoples all over the planet have considered the presence of their ancestors as sacred. I could read you poem after poem, song after song, story after story of people groups all over the world depicting the presence and power of the ancestors in Yoruba traditions, in Navajo traditions, in Quechua traditions. Traditions thousands of years old. If you watched the Winter Olympics Friday night, you saw the visual panoply of Korean traditions around the honor of the ancestors. Or if nothing else, you probably saw Coco over the holidays. Am I right? Yes, some of you did. Some of you need to. Just this week, a Facebook meme flashed on my timeline from a dear friend and poet, Marlanda de Kine. It read, "Walk like you have 3,000 ancestors walking behind you. Walk like you have 3,000 ancestors walking behind you." How would we walk if we believed that? What would our posture be like in the face of uncertainty, the face of injustice, the face of suffering, if we knew that the power of our ancestors carried us forward? course, this does get a little complicated because not all of our ancestors were very ethical people, were they? Our lives and stories are entangled in a past that is far from pure. And yet, when we think of ancestors given to us in our holy book and ancestors given to us in the stories who have long awaited their liberation, I'd say 3,000 of those folks behind me sure does feel pretty good. See, our ancestors remind us that we cannot avoid our histories. We cannot cut ourselves off from the past. We cannot act as though what happened yesterday does not affect today. Our ancestors are like a thread binding up the past and the present and pressing us into the future. But we have to listen to them and listen well. Kathy Lansing, I'm so grateful that you posted the article you did this week. I love it when you all help me write sermons. Seriously, it's a big help. It was an NPR piece that highlighted a recent report from the Southern Poverty Law Center. It begins like this. I'm going to read a little bit of it. In the ways that we teach and learn about the history of American slavery, the nation needs an intervention. This new report titled Teaching Hard History, American Slavery is meant to be that intervention, a resource for teachers who are eager to help their students better understand slavery and hear this well, not as some peculiar institution, but as the blood-soaked bedrock on which the United States was built. The report is also an appeal to states, school district leaders, and textbook makers to stop avoiding slavery's hard truths and lasting impact. It includes the dismal results of a new multiple-choice survey of 1,000 high school seniors, results that suggest many young people know little about slavery's origins and the government's role in perpetuating it. Just a third of students correctly identified the law that officially ended slavery, the 13th Amendment, and fewer than half knew of the Middle Passage. Most alarming, though, were the results to this question. And here's the question. What was the reason the South seceded from the Union? A, to preserve states' rights. B, to preserve slavery. C, to protest taxes on imported goods. D, to avoid rapid industrialization. E, not sure, that would have been honest. Nearly half blamed taxes on imported goods. Perhaps, the report's authors guess, students were confusing the Civil War with the Revolutionary War. How many students chose slavery as the reason the South seceded? I hear guesses. Okay, I like that. 8%. 8%. Dwelling with our ancestors, receiving their presence and wisdom among us is a reminder to me that we must have clarity about our past if we intend to construct any semblance of a vibrant future. We must know the story preceding us if we have any shot of carrying a brighter, wider, deeper story forward. We need to know what to hold on to and what to let go of. We need to carry the power of the past in our bones. We need to talk with the ancestors. We need their help getting the questions right on the multiple choice tests that shape our understanding of the past. And we need their help sifting through the lies that surround us. Lies that try to distort, repress, or re-narrate the past. Jesus needed to remember the cry that the people of Israel made in Egypt when they were held in bondage, when they were slaves. He needed to remember that God heard slavery's cry and called Moses to let her people go. Jesus needed to remember the time that the fiery prophet Elijah dared to stand before a wicked, greedy, violent king in defense of a little farmer named Naboth, who was murdered by this king because he wanted his one little plot of land. Jesus needed to remember the stories of Esther and Ruth, stories about women facing systemic violence and somehow making a way for their people. Jesus needed to remember that his present did not exist in a vacuum. It was shaped by, informed by, problematized by, and beautified by the work of his ancestors, so that's why they showed up. See, Jesus needed to remember every ounce of Moses' story if he was going to do this. Jesus needed to remember every ounce of Elijah's story if he was going to do this. Jesus needed to remember every ounce of Rahab's story, Bathsheba's story, Hagar's story, Abraham's story, Isaiah's story. He needed every ounce of every ancestor to show up for him. And he needed to remember that every day he was called to show up for them. Now, you may just think that I'm advocating for good history. And I hope you appreciate that, Pastor Elijah. Our resident theological historian, or our historical theologian, or our preacher who really loves history. You take your pick. And in one sense, I am. At a baseline level, I'm saying we need to know the past to tell the truth. But even beyond that, I'm saying we actually have to dwell with the past. Sit with the past. Meditate on the past. Stand on the mountain with the ancestors while they call us into tomorrow. So many wise leaders have done this work, haven't they? The work of conjuring, the work of truth-telling, the work of inviting the ancestors into rooms that we keep closing them out of. Dr. King knew the stories of the ancestors. He walked with 3,000 ancestors, reminding him over and over again about the story. There's this rare clip, it's not even really a speech, of Dr. King talking with folks in Mississippi as he was working to build a poor people's movement for the March on Washington. And he calls forth the ancestors, he conjures the reality of the past, and he tells the truth. Here's what he said. At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give them land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. But not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. But not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. But not only that, today, many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm. And they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself up by his own bootstraps. And this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. And he ends with a line that people rarely quote when they quote Dr. King. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check. Don't you wonder what Moses and Elijah might have been telling Jesus that afternoon on the mountain? Maybe they were waxing poetically about the Torah. It's nice. Or telling each other good fishing stories. Or just standing together in silence. But maybe, just maybe, maybe Moses and Elijah were saying to Jesus, it's time to get that check. It's time to tell the truth. It's time to awaken and disrupt the passive violence of the empire, spending time on military parades and not the poor. It's time to tell the kings of the world that while their power may be persistent, it will not prevail. When we refuse to dwell with the ancestors and deny the reality and complexity of our past, we end up making myopic, ill-informed decisions both within the church and beyond, decisions that are discriminatory, decisions that are rooted in denial and pacification, decisions that lack clarity and resolve and integrity. When we do dwell with the ancestors, we are transforming the burdens the ancestors bore that we still carry today in our bones and bodies and spirits. I'm talking about generational trauma, trauma that has been ingested for centuries by a legacy of the traumatized. Moses' children, Elijah's children, Ishmael's children, they carry the wounds of centuries in their spirits. And as Jesus stands before his ancestors, dazzling and bright, he reminds us all that there is transformation beyond the wounds of history. When we do dwell with the ancestors, we prepare and build a world that is ready for transformation, a future that is ripe with imagination and vision. As Moses and Elijah stand with Jesus, they see something both within their imagination and far beyond it. See, in their own lifetimes, they would have witnessed God's active work in the world more times than they could count. We're talking about the dude who parted the Red Sea. Somebody else filling the widow's jar. And yet, this must have been unlike anything they'd seen before. Here before them stood God in flesh, with them, not mysteriously in a burning bush or carrying them on a chariot of fire. God expressed in a body just like ours, transforming, transfiguring the past and illuminating the future. And so today, as we dwell with a new ancestor, a new saint, our dear brother, Paul Rice, transfigured and made new, and we remember the ancestors that keep calling us up the mountain and walking behind 3,000, 100,000, many billions strong. May our transfiguration, our illumination, and our truth-telling heal us and carry us all into, if you're up for it, tomorrow.